Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacy Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director, and Tiffany Mayberry, digital editor of the magazine. Today, we're going to hear Barbara's interview with Dr. Marta Hugas, chief scientist at the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, who joined us to discuss the Food Safety Authority's research priorities for the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, you know how I love talking science with folks.
So I know you were really.
Their research
geek heaven.
I was. Their research priorities, and it's really important, I think, that folks in the States who are so far removed from what's happening in Europe most of the time, they're really encapsulating what's truly important in this industry. So their priorities involve sustainability, innovation, and perception of risks. And one of their projects is called Holistic Risk Assessment, which is really not what it sounds like. It's really all about science communication. And I love talking with her about that because they not only focus on communication of science to the public, but also the interpretation and application of the collected data. So they're really trying to be the, you know, go-between, as it were, between the public and the food scientists. So it was great to talk to her about their work in that area.
Well, so you all want to stay tuned for that. And This episode came about in sort of a fun way, like everybody kind of had a hand in it. The good folks over at EFSA noticed an item that Tiffany had posted on our Food Safety Magazine newsfeed and thought and reached out because they thought that we might be interested in discussing this a little further. And, well, clearly we were. So, voila! We have more excellent and informative content for our podcast listeners the world over. And so I share this because I want to encourage you, dear listeners, don't be shy. Send us your suggestions. It's good for everyone. And here's where we get to thank one of our regular listeners, Elnaz Abdullahan. Please forgive me. I'm sure I did that wrong. Elnaz is a compliance manager at Northern Valley Packers in Perth, Australia. She posted a request on LinkedIn asking that we discuss food safety management in fruit packing houses. And that was quickly seconded by Larry Keener of International Product Safety Consultant, who is a member of our editorial advisory board and a recurring guest on the podcast. So lots of you know Larry. So we want to thank you for your comment, Elnaz. We're looking into this to see how best to address this on the podcast. Thank you. And as long as we're giving thanks, this podcast will be posted just 2 days before we celebrate Thanksgiving here in the U.S. There's still time to check those recipes and cooking times with Ask Karen.
Wrong.
What do you mean wrong?
Sorry to inform you, Stacy, but Ask Karen is no more. It's now Ask USDA.
What?
Newsflash. Yeah.
And I'm finding this out live on air. They where's Karen?
She's gone. So ask.
Karen's been abducted.
I guess so. Ask.usda.gov is where you want to go for all of your food safety related questions
ask,
now.
Okay, say it again.
Ask.usda.gov. There you go.
I liked Ask Karen. I mean, everybody knows I'm a total fangirl for Ask Karen. They just unceremoniously removed Karen.
Sorry.
But Stacy, you weren't going to be calling Ask Karen anyway.
Okay, true, that though that may be. like I shared recently on the podcast, even my neighbor asked me, if I do this, will I kill my family? And I say, Ask Karen. So Ask USDA. Say it again, Tiffany. It's askusda.gov.
Askusda.gov.
That's going to take some time.
I'm not going to be calling USDA, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the pie crust recipe that Lon sent over to me.
And let's be clear, for those who may have missed it, that's Lon Lamb from America's Test Kitchen. Barbara took the opportunity to ask her about pie crust while you had, as long as you had her.
Well, because, and so all of our listeners out there, if you can also help me. See, when I make a pie crust, it looks beautiful. And I crimp the edge and looks very beautiful. And I take a picture of the unbaked pie. But as soon as it goes into the oven, all that beautiful crimping just kind of melts into itself. And I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tastes fine. It just looks not great. So,
So are we going to get before and I want before and after pictures. We can, Tiffany,
I will do that.
And Tiffany, you can send those out on our social feeds so that people can judge for themselves how well Barbara did.
Please be nice to me. But I can do that. I can.
Okay.
We'll see.
All right.
We'll see what happens.
And so, as has been referenced here, I will not be cooking. I made reservations. I'm going to be up in Carmel, which I love, Carmel by the Sea. And then it's like, okay, well, I made the mistake last year of not making advance arrangements. So then I looked into what could I go, what could I do? And turns out that Clint Eastwood's Mission Ranch up there, they have a really a nice do that they do for Thanksgiving. But they don't start taking reservations until October 28th. So I was on the phone with Adam at the time. It was like 9 a.m. on October 28th. I'm like, dude, I got to go. I got to be call or not. I got to get on the phone and make reservations. And I did. I got them. So I will be eating on Thanksgiving. And Tiffany, what about you? I know you cook.
I do cook. And this will be the first year that I actually do not make a turkey. Yeah.
What will it be?
A vote. And, you know, turkey just isn't a favorite around here. So I just figured, why bother? So we had a vote between smothered turkey wings or a turkey breast and gravy. And smothered turkey wings won. So
it's turkey, just not the full thing. Just turkey wings.
That's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And smothered with what?
I can't tell you. It's a secret, like my secret script.
Okay, well, maybe there's a picture of that, too. We can see what they're smothered in later.
Ah, maybe.
Okay, maybe.
Well,
let's
just hope that all of this conversation about turkey and smothered wings and pie crust, it has met Claudio, our super fan from Stonyfield up in New Hampshire. He wanted to hear all of our Thanksgiving cooking story. So we hope that's
there we go.
So, well, then all this talk about USDA. So this reminds me, so this is a little bit of a soft intro to the news here, that USDA blew up Twitter again the other day when they posted, they did another post about washing, rinsing, or marinating meat or poultry in salt water, lemon juice, or vinegar does not destroy bacteria, only cooking to a proper temperature. And everybody lost their mind again. So I don't know. People really are resistant. So to EFSAs, you know, they know what they're doing. They know this is taking a lot to get people to change their habits. Please refer back to our friend Mindy Brashears, Dr. Brashears, second year study on just exactly where all those pathogens wind up all over your kitchen. All these people are so confident about where those pathogens wind up. They need to do a video or something and show people. Pictures. Because clearly the information that it's everywhere isn't doing the trick. Right, Barbara?
That's right.
Yeah. So
that's right.
Another reminder to listen to episode 60, Dr. Brashears. Kind enough to join us again on that study. All right. More news. Tiffany, news.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has begun collecting samples of raw agricultural commodity romaine lettuce, including trimmed and washed lettuce, in its natural form prior to processing. They will test for salmonella and shigatoxin-producing E. coli. The sampling assignment began this month and is expected to last for 1 year, with increased frequency in March and April and October and November, both time periods when previous romaine lettuce outbreaks occurred. No fresh-cut processed products will be collected or analyzed. 270 samples, all domestically grown, will be collected from FDA-registered facilities and farms that were identified by traceback in all of the recent foodborne outbreaks linked to romaine lettuce. Samples may be collected from wholesalers, food service distribution centers, and commercial cooling and cold storage facilities, including on-farm holding facilities. Samples will only be collected after harvest and not from farm fields. FDA has chosen to test for salmonella and E. coli because these microbial hazards have been repeatedly linked to foodborne illnesses associated with romaine lettuce consumption. If one of these pathogens is detected as part of the sampling assignment, FDA will perform whole genome sequencing of the microorganism's DNA to determine the severity and whether it's genetically related to isolates causing human illness. The assignment is intended to help not only FDA, but the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as state public health agencies, to develop targeted investigations of foodborne illness outbreaks.
They're still not going to get to a root cause this way, though.
Heavy sigh. Well, they're going to try. So, they're going to keep trying until we solve this mystery. I mean, you got to start somewhere before you can start to actually work your way back to a root cause. I mean.
But as we learn from the next story that Tiffany will tell us about, because this was one after cutting and processing, it seems to me that with the outbreaks that have happened already, there was a lot of environmental strains that matched the outbreak strain. But this particular story, they're not looking at environmental contaminants. They're not looking at the lettuce on the farm, but only after it's been trimmed and washed. And those processes can introduce contamination. So I'd be curious to see what they really want to, you know, what is the take home that they hope to achieve from this study? Be interesting.
Well, but if they mark it, if they get the DNA on it, then aren't they going to be able to start going back from there, right? And get to root cause. I mean, because at this point, it's like we don't really know much of anything. So any information is helpful at this point.
We shall see. We shall see.
So we'll see. Yeah. Let's hope. We wish you luck.
More E. coli, more lettuce. So the Maryland Department of Health is investigating a cluster of E. coli 0157H7 infections in 7 patients, all of them reported eating the same chicken Caesar salad product sold at Sam's Club. One unopened salad kit that was purchased by one of the outbreak patients was tested. The romaine lettuce in that salad kit did test positive for the presence of E. coli. Bonduelle, the company that makes the salad kits, released a statement saying they test all of their leafy greens in the field prior to harvest. This includes testing romaine lettuce for the presence of E. coli. The company is working with the Maryland Health Department to identify the root cause of the outbreak. Because the product in question had a use-by date of October 31st, no recall was issued because it was believed that the salad kits were no longer on store shelves. The investigation is ongoing and more lab testing is expected.
So I had a couple thoughts on this. The first is that just because they tested lettuce in the field and it came back negative doesn't mean it's really negative, unless they test 100% of it, which no one ever does. But the other thing, like I mentioned earlier, is these were bag salad kits. So they had to wash them, cut them, and bag them. So obviously, if they think were not contaminated in the field, then it's one of their processes that introduced it, and they need to check that out.
So, all right.
Last week, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand penned a letter to U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue asking for more transparency regarding the U.S. Department of Agriculture's microbiological testing data collected from meat and poultry slaughterhouses and processing plants. The letter was prompted after the most recent outbreak of Salmonella Dublin that's been linked to ground beef products. The outbreak has caused at least 8 hospitalizations and 1 death. Even though USDA has identified the outbreak strain in 6 samples of raw ground beef products, the agency has yet to identify any single or common supplier of contaminated meat. However, USDA's own website has logged a recall of 34,000 pounds of ground beef products, a recall issued by Hanford, California-based Central Valley Meat Company. The recall was prompted after the company was notified of a cluster of salmonella illnesses. A traceback investigation indicated that a patient in the current outbreak did consume ground beef produced by Central Valley Meat. USDA has started using whole genome sequencing as part of their routine sampling. While they do share information about microbiological sampling with both companies and the public, that does not include whole genome sequencing data. The Congresswoman and Senator are specifically asking that USDA begin disclosing FSIS numbers associated with each pathogen isolate. The FSIS number can be used to search for genetically matching or highly similar pathogens in the National Center for Biotechnology Information Pathogen Browser tool. There, users can identify links between a pathogen found in an establishment and one that has made people sick. According to the letter, USDA officials have said they do not disclose genetic data because doing so would cause public confusion, and it might require public health authorities to focus their attention on misleading claims.
Okay, Stacey.
Let's hear it, Barbara.
Oh, you want to start with me. Okay. My question is, and we've talked about the work of the caucus in the past and Rosa and her group, but while they are asking for things and recommending things be done, I'm wondering if they've actually moved the needle in what they've asked for. I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I think it's important from a traceability perspective, but I do understand from a scientist that sometimes, even in the interest of traceability, that the general public doesn't understand science. So you can't just release a bunch of data and expect the public to know what it is. I think a lot more work would need to happen to connect the dots for people for it to be meaningful.
And I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm just saying that it was newsworthy when lawmakers get involved. That was my only point, is to say, you know, it's one thing to have just sort of out there, you know, an idea that we need more transparency. And their point that wasn't covered here, Tiffany didn't touch on specifically, was that even people within the supply chain need to be able to make choices, right, about where they're. So it does put some, if that were to happen, I'm not sure about going all the ins and outs of what they're proposing, but that even within the supply chain that people should have this data, it could impact and have a way of rooting out, you know, lesser suppliers, bad actors. And that would be a good thing, right? You start to get the public involved. And I mean, I do understand the challenges certainly of, as is like the theme, communicating with consumers, right? Certainly point well taken. But it is interesting, I think, when lawmakers get involved into your, and again, yeah, we'll see how far they get, but there is some pressure. So sometimes pressure does lead to change. So we'll see what, we'll keep an eye on it and see what happens.
Well, and I think we also have extended the invitation. I know I've reached out to DeLauro's staff, you know, she's happy to come on the podcast and talk with us about the changes that the caucus would like to see and how they've been able to move the needle forward. You know, we hear about when they write a letter, when they make a request, but we don't hear anything about the resolution of that. So yeah, love to hear more.
We would love that. Let's reach out again. Let's see. Maybe though, maybe it could happen.
You can read these stories and more on foodsafetymagazine.com. And if you're not already, you can follow our updates on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Just search for Food Safety Magazine.
Okay, next up is Barbara's interview with Dr. Marta Hugas, Chief Scientist at the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, where she oversees the development of EFSA's scientific strategic direction, manages scientific matters, and facilitates the understanding of science, fosters scientific cooperation, and leverages connections and networks to promote EFSA's research priorities. Since joining EFSA in 2003, she's led the Biological Hazards Unit, the Risk Assessment and Scientific Assistance Department, and the Biological Hazards and Contaminants Unit. Marta holds a bachelor's degree in biological sciences, a master's degree in genetics and microbial biotechnology, as well as a PhD in food microbiology. Prior to joining EFSA, she worked for the Institute for Food and Agricultural Research and Technology in Spain, where she was the head of the Food Microbiology and Biotechnology Unit. Marta's areas of expertise focus on food hygiene, the development of starter and bioprotective cultures, probiotics for the safety of poultry, emerging preservation of technologies, and risk assessment of biological hazards.
Yeah, I really don't have much to add. I had the most fun talking to her about the science communication part of it, obviously. But yeah, they do a lot more than you would think, digging around.
Well, so here's that interview now.
Hi, Marta. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Barbara. Also my pleasure to talk to you.
I'm looking forward to learning about the research priorities at the European Food Safety Authority, otherwise known as EFSA, and your priorities in the years to come. So let's get started. So your recent publication in the EFSA journal outlined the 5 to 10 year plans for how research can stimulate innovation and how science can be communicated effectively. And particularly for us at Food Safety Magazine, science communication is really important to us. So can you please describe for our audience what went into developing the research priorities that you presented in the article?
Yes, as you may know, EFSA is the body in the European Union that deliver food safety risk assessment in food and feed areas, going from animal health and to nutrition. So we typically identify in our daily work gaps in research, gaps in knowledge, and that and then we cannot move forward. So the idea was to identify this gap so that the research-funded programs in the European Union could tackle those so that we would not block innovation when a product, a process comes to our plate. So the idea is that to be ready, to be prepared for the future, and we need these gaps to be filled. So what we did was we collected recommendations from our scientific experts working with us in our scientific panels in the scientific committee, what they would feel that was missing and which knowledge they would further need on the work they do. And we also then collected the views from participants in our 2018 scientific conference. And we consulted also our stakeholders and the member states on what would be the needs they would need to fill the gaps that they see in the daily work they do. So also considering the UN Sustainable Development Goals and the citizens' request for sustainable and safe food regulatory science, we also introduced that in our research needs. And maybe the main difference in the past, because we have been doing this since many years, every 3 years we collect these views, but in the past it was more a shopping list, you know, kind of titles of projects that we would need. This time we changed a bit the narrative and we introduced not only the needs we see, but also what would be the impact of those, of the outcome of the research projects if they were to be carried out, how we will see our work being different and what will be the impact of this new information coming to our plate.
I also read that the plans are meant to inform research agendas, such as those of Horizon Europe. So could you take a few minutes just to describe this research program?
Yes, in the European Union, we typically have every 5 years what we call framework research programs. And now we are coming to the end of the current research program, which is it's called Horizon 2020, and already putting the basis for the next research program that will be called Horizon Europe. And within this Horizon Europe, the food research falls with one of the challenges called the Global Challenge on Industrial Competitiveness, which will be funded with 52 billion euros. And this program is supposed to directly support research relating to societal challenges and reinforcing technological and industrial capacity, and also setting EU-wide missions with ambitious goals, tackling some of our European biggest programs. And this program, it's supposed also to include activities pursued by the Joint Research Center in the European Union, which supports EU and national policymakers with independent scientific evidence and technical support. And within this pillar, there is a cluster that's where we are interested in. And this cluster is called Food, Bioeconomy, Natural Resources, and Agriculture and Environment. And this research has been proposed to be funded with 10 billion euros budget. So we believe that it's very important that Europe invest in this, because we see since many years the global demand for natural resources has more than tripled and is now exceeding planetary boundaries. So we need that to invest in food safety and in food issues, because these are also very important elements for the economic growth in the European Union.
Right, that's so important, the issue of sustainability, particularly. So what you're describing, and the emphasis on food safety, is that part of the research area called safe food systems? And if not, how does that differ?
Yeah, this is included, of course, in one of the research streams that we have identified in our paper. And it's because the safety assessments are very vertical. They are driven by vertical legislation. So, for example, we assess one pesticide, we assess one food additive, we assess one health claims. But what we believe is that in the future, we need to escape compartments and be more cross-cutting, more horizontal, more holistic. And looking ahead, and taking into consideration the sustainability of the system, as well as what we understand now in Europe, the European Green Deal, we should develop more cross-cutting interdisciplinary methodology to carry out food safety assessments. And in our paper, we also highlighted that to improve food safety, we need to move towards alternative and sustainable production system. And this includes having methodologies for food risk analysis, also moving the way we think about how to reduce maybe the use of chemicals in the food chain, how to replace them, and how to reorganize the way we see the food chain, taking into account, again, the sustainable development goals and also the desire of the citizens for maybe a wall with less chemicals or with more safety chemicals, in our food, and also to ensure food, feed, and nutrition security, which is already very high. I believe that the European consumers are one of the best protected consumers in the world, but still, they demand more and more protection, and they demand more and more safety. Despite, as I say, that we are one of the areas in the world with the lowest burden of disease compared to other regions. We also want that this research has an impact on social sciences, so that anticipates how social sciences as climate change, consumer choices, personalized nutrition drive changes in exposure patterns and choices in diets that may constitute new hazards. Also, how also to protect consumers when we are exposed to new innovative products.
Now, the research that you're describing, how might that impact access to food, food security? you know, maybe there, this is not as much of an issue in Europe as it is in the developing world. But could you comment on that?
Yes, of course, food security is a very important element if we are serious about also about the Green Deal and about sustainable society. So it's also about food waste, but also we understand, as the FAO already mentioned last year or earlier this year, that if food isn't safe, it could not be called food. So food security cannot be understood without food safety. And the research stream we are proposing also shall consider impacts on food safety of innovation in food production and food systems. And as risk assessment operates at the science policy interface, informing decision and policymaker and food safety, this is the integral part of food and nutrition security, the way we understand it. Also, anticipating impacts on food safety of innovation in food production and food systems is also very important, because it's not enough to assess risk, but we also need to see what are the benefits, what are the impacts, what are the alternatives that need to be assessed, and for who has to bear the risk and who bears the benefit. So, in a nutshell, also is this preparedness for big social changes related to climate change and changing consumers' choices and being prepared for that.
Right. Now, you mentioned risk assessment. That's another research area that you described in your paper. It was called innovation and risk assessment. So what impact do the research findings in this area have on testing methods and other forms of technology that are currently used?
As though traditionally, the research programs have been focused on growth and innovation. And if we look at from this perspective, at the first glance, could be seen that food safety is not part of that. But the other part of the coin is that if a new product that has developed using innovative approaches and research funds directed to be innovative, if we are not in the possession having of the right methodologies to assess this innovation, we are blocking innovation. So that's why it's very important that we are aware how we can assess new risks that might come to our plate, and that we are aware what's in the pipeline of industry, what is industry developing that in some years of time will come to our plate. And without challenging the independence of EFSA, also we need to be aware of new developments. And the highlights from this paper that we published, the 2030 Food Safety Research Paper, is about anticipating the impact of innovations and new technologies on an integrated risk assessment. So how we can be ready, how we can protect consumers by doing a safety assessment of something that has been developed and is new when it comes to our plate, when it comes to EFSA in a pre-market evaluation. So we need integrated approaches, for example, to pests and diseases in animal and in plants and animal production, integrated approaches for assessing chemical and microbiological hazards and antimicrobial resistance, also integrated outcomes of human and environmental risk assessment. So is the concept is being ready, being prepared, by knowing what will come to our plate, and also having the methodologies ready to do this safety assessment.
Sure. Now, I imagine that the expertise required to do all of this is very broad. So is there an effort to enlist researchers outside the food industry, outside food science and food safety, to move the needle? And I'm thinking maybe filtration chemists or polymer scientists, folks that have made innovative advances in other related fields, but not directly food.
Thank you for the question, because I think in this sense that the regulators, where they set up EFSA, set up EFSA in a kind of a very flexible way, because we don't we don't recruit all of the scientists that work with us, but we tap on the knowledge, on the expertise that is in the European member states. So the way we are set up is that we are flexible, allowing us to work with the best experts in a given area. So, for example, if we receive a new question, let's say on genome editing of insects, We map which kind of expertise we need to answer the request we receive from our policymakers. We identify which areas of work we need, and also we take into account the borders of expertise, let's say, the margins of a given expertise. So to have also people that think out of the box and work with us. So this is a very stimulating way of working with EFSA because we can tap with the best experts in a given area. And also internally, because we are about more or less 460 people in the moment, we will now expand that. We also have a very agile, multidisciplinary team because our staff members come across from across Europe and across different scientific disciplines. So we have all kinds of expertise: veterinarians, toxicologists, epidemiologists, data scientists, food scientists. And we are also, with the help of our human capital department, also reflecting and thinking by mapping competence we have and mapping the competence we will need. So to be agile in recruiting new expertise to work with us on as a staff member, but also, as I said, tapping with the best experts working in academia, in research, in universities, in research institutes across Europe. And then we set our panels. We have 10 scientific panels and one scientific committee, which are also composed of 21 experts in each of the panels, that have a good interdisciplinary distribution, so that we seek that people can challenge each other and work on each other's expertise, because our panels, in a way, they are the peer reviewers or the work that is mostly developed by a working group. And a working group is most of the time a group of experts that are set up to deliver a report on a given topic. And then the panels review, peer review the work of the working group, give directions to them, and we always seek this collegiate agreement, consensuated agreement from different disciplines, so that to give an opinion to the European policymakers. We can also work with industry. We have very strict independence requirements. The experts working with us need to be very independent, and they should not have received money from the industry. They should not have been consulting with industry. And we have a kind of a period that, if they have done that, they cannot work for us. But we are also aware that often the most of the knowledge is in industry experts. So we also have a figure, we call them hidden experts, so that experts that we know they have a conflict, but still they have a good knowledge, and they can come and give testimony to us. We can send a set of questions to them, and they can provide us their expertise, but they cannot influence the drafting of a given document.
That's a great system. I really like that. I run into that myself, trying to assess folks to write for the magazine, for example. How do you envision that this research would shift kind of in real life how risk assessments are performed, or change current practices maybe on the farm? Are there some real life examples you can provide for us?
Yes, I think now we are at the moment that if we take seriously, the indications we see regarding climate change, and also the need to provide food with a growing population in the world, with maybe not more arable land than the one we have today, we have important challenges ahead of us. So we are at the beginning of an important transformation. And we had also recently the latest World Food Day, and the logo was Healthy Diets for Zero Hunger World, nourishing people and nurturing the planet through sustainable, healthy diets for all. So we need to meet the Sustainable Development Goals in 2030, which is just very close. It's, if we count in harvesting time, we can have 10 harvests before 2030. So we need to produce enough food, but we also need to produce the food from a sustainable perspective. And to do that, we need research. For example, research in precision agriculture could lead to use maybe new breeding techniques, new ways of increasing resilience of plants, resilience of animals that are less, they may be prone to get disease, or maybe using less chemicals or chemicals that are more environmental friendly and they don't pollute then the effluents, if we think also with a circular economy. So food is back at the center of the agenda. But this time we realize we need to address a lot of issues, and sustainability is one of the most important ones. And for example, Europe now, the new commissioner has also set up this goal of this Green Deal, and we want to be the first continent to be climate neutral by 2030. So the answer to that can only come from research. And sustainability, digitization of agriculture, the sustainable development goals, the common agriculture policy reform, and climate change are the drivers of the change, and we need to be serious. And we don't have the knowledge today. So the knowledge, the answers can only come from research.
Right. A really important project for the whole world, let alone Europe. But we're hoping you guys can lead the way for the rest of us. The last research area that you described in the paper was holistic risk assessment, which involves understanding the context, delivering communication of impactful science. And like I mentioned earlier, this is near and dear to my heart as a fellow communicator of science. So as I understand this area, it not only focuses on communication of science to the public, but also the interpretation and application of collected data. So a lot of buzzwords surrounding this: machine learning, the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence. But for a moment, let's focus on the communication side. So what approaches does your group use to communicate food safety related information to the public? This is a challenge, at least in the US. So I'd love to hear what you folks have found that works.
Yes, this is also one of our main tasks. We are assessing risk, but also communicating on the risk. And this is a very big challenge for us, because also in Europe, food is very emotional. There are many values that go with food. So, and we have consumers that three times per day need to take informed choices on what they are going to eat. So it's it's something that it's important to everybody as a consumer. So EFSA has been trying different ways of communicating, because by definition we are a transparent organization. We publish everything we do, all the opinions of our panels, all the risk assessments we do, they are published. But this is not enough. So we also sometimes, when we communicate on risk, consumer often would like to see a black or white. And very often, as you very well know, it's a full shade of grays. And uncertainty also plays an important role. So how to communicate straightforward messages?
Right.
So for that, we sometimes have like layman summaries. We also have infographics on our website. We also trying to digest the complexity of our opinions. But we also believe that research is needed also to understand better the context and how to deliver and communicating impactful science, how to integrate risk and benefit assessment, which tools for data-driven food systems should be there, how we can also engage with the consumers that they could also contribute to our work, for example, through crowdsourcing initiatives and different ways to engage, because it's not only one-way direction, it's not only us delivering communication, but communication has also the other side. So how we could better understand how to reach best the consumer. So we also believe that research is needed in the area in building capacity for future transdisciplinary expertise, social research to understand citizens' awareness, perceptions, and behavior in the area of food safety, improvements to the way science is communicated and will contribute to accountability and make us our organization more trustworthy, not only us, but also other regulatory bodies, while understanding citizens' perceptions and how this will inform risk communication so that we can employ a tailored approach to meet the information needs of our target audiences. And how can we identify the right timing and adequate methods of engaging with the society during the risk assessment process? And while we acknowledge that research in this area is very important, you know, the science of communicating and science of how to communicate risks, and just the word of risk already makes consumers scared. You know, if we all communicate on risk, that means already that there's something like negative. So we launched earlier this year what we call the Eurobarometer, which is a kind of a survey asking the citizens, and I think the sample was targeting more than 30,000 consumers on several of questions. And we learned many important messages, some of them against the myths that we had already that contradict a bit what we're taking for granted. For example, the majority of Europeans consider food safety as one of the many factors that influences their dietary habits, together with price, taste, nutritional content, and origin of food. But only 1 in 5 report that food safety is their top concern. So 4 out of 5 understand that food safety is there. It's already granted. And that's a very important message. Also, we learn that contrary to what we thought, that now maybe social media, social channels, where the most of the consumers, you know, got their information, we learn that television remains the main source of information on food-related risks. And 2/3 of Europeans report that based on the information they heard about a specific risk, they change their eating behavior, either temporarily or permanently, to mitigate the potential food safety risk. So, of course, we acknowledge that maybe in the young population, social channels are the ones that are more trusted, but still overall is television and the written newspapers where the consumers take most of the information. And also we learned that as Europe is very diverse, it's very cultural risk, it's very varied, there is no single food safety concern that prevails in all countries. So we see that in some member states, they are more worried about antibiotics in farm animals. In others, they are more worried about pesticide residues in food, others in environmental pollutants. So that also will help us how to best target our audience. Another important message was that scientists enjoy the highest level of trust among Europeans when it comes to information related to food risks, followed by consumer organizations and farmers. And I could go on and on, but maybe just to highlight that also, if we ask our consumers about what is the most concern, we see that concerns over GMOs have also gone down compared to 10 years ago. But we see other rising concerns, such as microplastics, especially in Northern Europe, which is, of course, also issues that we need to tackle and see how we can also contribute from our perspective to best inform and also to give to the policymakers the best advice on how to handle some of these risks. So we need to understand better how to best inform our consumers so that they can take the best informed, science-based informed decisions on their diets.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that scientists are held in such high esteem in Europe. I think here, sometimes people are afraid of what they don't understand. And maybe that's the case in Europe too, that you really walk a fine line knowing how much science to really throw out there at consumers. It really has to be, you know, geared to a relatively simplistic level of understanding to get the point across. It's difficult challenge, but I'm very happy that scientists are regarded so highly. So you've talked a little bit about that folks there seem not so resistant to science-based information, that they're regarding science very highly. Have you ever had to combat a more resistant mindset. You mentioned that for GMOs, for example, that opinion about that has changed. Are there other kind of set in stone opinions of folks that you've noticed that runs counter to science that you're having to make maybe a special effort to kind of change the mindset in particular areas?
Yeah, well, maybe just also to be clear that concerns over GMOs have gone down, but it is also because, in Europe, we are not cultivating GMOs in most member states, and also the policy is very strict, so we have not as many GM products on the market as you have. So that's also why maybe also the concerns have gone down, just to be clear. But because in Europe, food is so emotional. And, this is a topic that while we eat, we keep talking about food. And everybody has also their own ideas about food. And typically also consumers believe that maybe the most traditional way of producing food is also the safest one, which is not necessarily true. We are also confronted how to integrate emotions in our communications, and this is very, very difficult. We try to be as open as we can and also as engaging as possible with our communication, so that we try to reach the different categories of stakeholders, so also to influence the influencers in a way. So if our stakeholders trust what we do and they feel that we are trustworthy, they could also transmit that. But still, we are confronted with people that believe that, we should have no pesticides at all, or that we should be producing food the same way that our great-grandparents were producing, without realizing that actually we have improved a lot the way we produce food and the way we get sick from food. And we see every year that most of the foodborne diseases, they are not increasing. And we had also in Europe a big success in decreasing salmonellosis, the diseases produced from salmonella by half in 10 years. And this would not have been possible without also using vaccines, for example, and vaccinating the laying hens or great, up to the pyramid of poultry production. So we also need to be humble and acknowledge, where we are and that we are not successful in everything we do. But the way we believe that we can combat maybe some old-fashioned mindset or mindset that are not really based on science is by being very humble on communicating, but being very open, being also engaging and consulting publicly on some of our draft risk assessments, and also trying to explain as much as we can ourselves, but also our colleagues in member states, the challenges we have had and the advice we give. But we also see that the advice we give is very well cited in scientific publication, is indexed in scientific databases, so that how much we reach out, we are trying to reach out as much as possible, scientists in member states, and also that the publication of our advice follows a robust quality management system, which is ISO 9001 certified, so that by also ensuring quality, we also believe that we will also reach out more, and that science will be the basis of the belief or the knowledge of our consumers. But it's not black or white, so we are in the journey. It's not that we are there already.
Right. I certainly appreciate your reference to, consumers often want something that's black or white, but the complexity of the food supply and even individual food products does make everything a different shade of gray. So it is an interesting challenge for the science-based communication. Now, if we return for a moment to the collection and utility of big data, what would you say is the overall goal of the research theme in this area?
Well, as our core business is risk assessment, and we understand that the three ingredients of risk assessment is having the right methods, having the right data, and having the right brains. So that can make the sense of all the data by using an agreed methodology that is also transparent and it's also agreed at the international level. So data is our core business, is in our DNA, is something we could not go without. And now also with the big availability of data and the big distribution of data, we also believe and are convinced that we are moving from the time where we were just kind of hosting data in our organization. So now what we believe is that we need to reach out. We need to make our systems interoperable so that they can go and connect data, databases that are placed elsewhere, that we could just send a query and retrieve the right information back without hosting all the data in a given organization. So, and we believe that no one can collect all the relevant data in one site. So it's about opening data sets and having interoperable data. And recently we had the revision of our funding regulation that we call the General Full Law. And this has triggered a scientific breakthrough because now we are working that all the data that will be submitted to us, all the dossiers that a given applicant, I think you call it a sponsor in the US, so that has made the development and wants it to get a safety assessment, we will, by law, be publishing everything. So the confidential data will be kept to a real minimum, not to damage the sustainability or the business of a given sponsor, of a given applicant. But most of the data will be published so that it can be downloadable, can be reusable, because we also believe that by doing so, the work we do could be better scrutinized. And we are very believing of that scrutiny is an important part to gain also trust in the consumers, with other scientists that work in different areas, with researchers in universities. So when this new regulation will enter into force, that will be spring 2021, by that time, we will need to have all the necessary IT systems, workflows that will make all our data open and accessible to everybody. So this is because we really believe that that's the only way to go. It's transparency and it's engagement. It's being open so that it's not that we do our science with closed doors, but what we do can be scrutinized by everybody else. And in this, it's also very important to use more and more new technologies. And we are exploring also how to use artificial intelligence, because the more efficient we can be, if we need to assess a topic that behind there is about thousands of scientific papers, the more we can technify these, the more we can have them machine readable, we will be quicker, we will have less resources, and we could do more. So we are also reflecting on how we can work on that, how we can also use the crowdsourcing. And we had already two initiatives by EFSABIA, the Innocentive platform, which I think is a US-based platform. And the first challenge had in 2017 asked for ideas about how to visualize scientific uncertainty, the limitations in available knowledge. And then last year, we had a second challenge, which aimed to find ways to automate systematic reviews, the data extraction step of scientific assessments. And now, at the end, in the coming weeks, we will also launch a new project that's called MammalNet, that's aiming at assessing the feasibility of the application of citizen science in monitoring wildlife at European level in four member states. Because, as you know, also wildlife is an important driver for spreading some animal diseases that also challenge food security. And so we are also, reflecting and seeing how we can involve the crowd to help us, exploring the knowledge in some important areas.
That's really great to try and you know, get ordinary members of the public to be involved in this and take some ownership of driving science forward. That's really exciting. So, Marta, as the chief scientist at EFSA, what are your primary research priorities, and where do they fit into the plans we've talked about today?
Thank you very much, Barbara. This is a very important question, because I talk about the research programs and the Horizon Europe, but the outcome of these research programs, if they follow our research needs, will only come in 5-7 years. So we have immediate needs that they cannot be covered by these Horizon Europe programs. So our immediate needs are to be covered by what we call our grants and procurements program. And for that, we have a limited budget, but it's also an important budget with the help of the organization in member states. So we outsource the project, and then organizations in member states apply for it. And these are the needs that then will be covered in maybe 2 to 4 years. So, and we also partner with other research organizations. For example, the European Union Joint Research Center, the JRC, to carry out researches on a particular topic. For example, they help us in our plant pest categorization and the socioeconomic analysis. We partner with them. We also partner with our sister agencies. We have in the European Union more than 40 agencies, but 5 of them are very close to us. We call them sister agencies: the Medicine Agency, the Chemical Agency, the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, and the European Environmental Agency. And with some of them, we partner on areas that we have common interest. For example, on cumulative risk assessment or on bee health. And also now, thanks to this new legislation, our budget will be increased, hopefully, because still this needs to be finally fine-tuned by our masters in the European Union. So the process will gain in efficiency, and we'll also have more budget to outsource so that we can also cover our midterm needs. And in this, I mentioned bees, but also I mentioned cumulative risk assessment, but also landscape environmental risk assessment. Artificial intelligence is also a very important area. Biotechnologies, you know, how also to be equipped with genomics, with metabolomics, with proteomics, this whole genome sequence, and the new techniques that now will come to our plate on genome editing, for example, how to be equipped with that. So all these areas are very important and challenging areas that we cannot also address them alone, but we need to partner. And for that, we also count on partnering with international organizations in the US, with the European, with your Environmental Protection Agency, with the Food and Drug Administration, with the USDA. So that's also, we need to join forces, because the world is global. And when we trade foods, we also trade hazards and we trade risks. So we need to partner and work together.
Right. Very important statement right there. So, Marta, as we wrap up today, what excites you the most about the plans that were laid out in this article?
Well, I think that now in the EU, we have a very challenging time to try to meet the sustainable development goals that our member states adhere to, set up by the UN. And now with a new commission, this Green Deal, so how to can manage to have a sustainable food systems that make our planet greener, safer, and also that we can protect the planet for the future generations. I think that's make my work really exciting, and I really hope and trust that we could achieve that and leave to the future generations a better planet than the one we received.
Right, and I think that the plan is they've been laid out really hold a promise to advance food safety and food security, as you mentioned, with the sustainability efforts. It's very ambitious, but we look forward to following the research as you folks are publishing and helping you spread the news.
Thank you very much, Barbara. It's most appreciated.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you today, Marta, and really getting a sense of the priorities in Europe right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Marta Hugas for taking the time to join us to represent EFSA on the podcast today. And thanks to all of you for listening. You'll find links for all the references that we've mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast, then find episode 61. Don't forget, send us your questions and suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. As you can tell, we read that stuff. We need it. Come on, don't be shy. What? Come on. You haven't subscribed to Food Safety Matters yet? I don't buy it. But if that's true, it's not too late. Click on that subscribe button so that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your library and you get those fun reminders. Non-subscribers don't get any of that. They wait, they wonder, did I miss anything? Don't do that. Subscribe! All right, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode and the last episode of 2019 will post on December 10th. We'll talk to you then.